For the past 2 years, humanity has been under attack and entire populations have been put under draconian restrictions under the claim that there is a pandemic. For those of us that can see there is no evidence of a virus, the war on humanity is even more egregious. However, within the wider circle of those questioning the COVID narrative, a common theme is that something is badly wrong with the offered solution in the form of experimental vaccines. By early 2020, globalist organisations were indicating the rollout of their touted universal vaccines and an injection in every arm. In 2021, citizen scientists began examining the injections under the microscope, and the revelations were startling. At the forefront of the research has been the La Quinta Columna team, who have produced many light and electron micrograph images, as well as detailed analysis of self-assembling particles, graphene components, and potential nanotechnology. Here in New Zealand, we also have several teams who have backed up these findings. Of course, there have been dismissals that we are just seeing artifacts or innocent crystals. That's why we asked Dr. Robin Wakeling, a senior microbiologist and nano-emulsion delivery technology expert, to perform his own analysis of the Pfizer BioNTech product. He joined my husband, Dr. Mark Bailey, to explain the behaviour of the product under the microscope, over time, and under the influence of various environmental factors. He compares his findings to known colloidal structures and other vaccines, and as per other investigators around the world, reaches some disturbing conclusions.
Welcome everyone. I'm Dr. Mark Bailey in Christchurch, New Zealand, and it's my pleasure to be speaking with Dr. Robin Wakeling, coming in from Wellington, New Zealand. Robin is a microbiologist, PhD, a world expert in decay and mold forensics. He's supervised polymerase chain reaction research and been a vocal critic of the pseudoscience taking place in the alleged COVID pandemic. Robin has thousands of hours of microscopy experience and has previously been involved in the development of patented nano-emulsion delivery technologies. So what better person to take a look at the Pfizer BioNTech product up close? Now, we've seen from some of the electron microscopy images coming in from other countries such as Spain and Germany, which have demonstrated that the injections contain what appear to be undeclared constituents, including graphene oxide and what could be interpreted as being nanotechnology. Today we're going to take a look at the Pfizer product under the light microscope for ourselves and see how it behaves on a slightly larger scale and how perhaps that compares to the overseas findings. So Robin, I'll hand over to you, and perhaps you can start by telling the audience what kind of microscope you're using and the types of or degrees of magnification we're looking at.
Okay, thanks, Mark. I used a compound light microscope with a basic magnification of 650, although the software that puts it on the computer screen sort of doubles that approximately. I use phase contrast most of the time. A couple of the images are using bright field and polarized light. And then I've included a few images of other workers which were dark field, but most of my work was with phase contrast. And the magnification and scale, I'll remind the audience of that as we go through. Okay, so I suppose the overarching theme of this presentation is what, if any, are the undisclosed ingredients in Comirnaty? We know that there's at least two declared undisclosed ingredients. In other words, they're just coded. We don't know what they are on the basis that they are proprietary excipients. So we know that there are some unknowns, and possibly there are some undeclared unknowns also. So that's really the overarching question that we're addressing. Okay, so this is just a quick summary of what I'm going to cover so you know what's coming. Part one is relatively short. I'm going to give a very quick abstract of the findings so you can see some of the images very quickly. I'm not going to spend a long time describing them. I'm going to do that in detail in part two, but it's just a quick snapshot of what you're going to see during part two. And I'm going to give a brief introduction to that sort of sets the scene. What are the listed constituents in Comirnaty? So we can put any non-listed ones into context. Just a quick brief explanation of the principles of mRNA formulation chemistry, how that's achieved in the Comirnaty formulation, so we can understand some of the images that we're looking at. And the same little bit of background on the microscopy and the nanoscale. What is the nanoscale? What size does that cover? Graphene oxide. What evidence is there that graphene oxide may be contained in Comirnaty and some of the other COVID-19 vaccines? And then we're going to move into part two, which is the bulk of the presentation, which is the actual videos of the micrographs. So what we actually saw under the light microscope. I'm going to dive right in off the deep end into a quick abstract of the findings. And then I'm going to step back and explain those findings so that they're understandable. So don't worry if the first few images don't make sense. There are three main findings that the microscopic images that we're producing are suggesting, the key findings. So the first one is that the lipid nanoparticles that are contained in Comirnaty, and I'll explain what LNPs are in a moment, but it appears that they are continuing to self-assemble in a way that forms much larger colloidal structures of some highly varied and somewhat rarefied forms. The second main key finding was that these colloidal structures then seem to change their form in response to collision with interfaces like the glass surfaces of the microscope preparations or air bubbles or other interfaces, whereby they start to take on a much more structured and unnatural formation with a lot of straight lines and right angles, sort of things that don't usually occur in nature outside of crystallography. And what we're going to be showing most of the time has some profound differences to crystal structure. So we'll cover that too. And so the third finding, which is where the other two kind of lead to, and it's where other workers have sort of jumped into the deep end with some of the dark field work that's been done. These right-angled sheets and wires that seem to form from the colloidal structures go on in some situations where it appears that some environmental triggers are involved. More about that later. They seem to order themselves in a highly ordered, complex way, in a way that is quite unusual. Certainly not something that the people who are looking at this have seen before. And these are people who should be familiar with this sort of thing. So those are the three main findings. I'm just going to show some very quick images to illustrate those. So this is a light micrograph of these colloidal structures that form from the lipid nanoparticles. What you're looking at there, this thing in the middle here, looks a bit like a jellyfish. I'll keep restarting the video so you can see it moving. But this is a very large coalescence of lipid nanoparticles, most likely. So you've got a large droplet here. I apologize, there's no scale on this one. There is a scale on some of the others, but this is about 15 microns across. So it's a spherical droplet of something. And then there's a tail coming off that, a series of much smaller droplets all joined up to form a long tail. And this one up here, you can see, is a slightly smaller droplet with a very long tail on it, where all the droplets have coalesced into this long thread. And if I keep restarting the video, you'll see it actually moving around. So the long tail goes all the way from there all the way up to the droplet. And you can see these larger droplets forming a tail also moving around. Okay, so more about that in a minute. Those seem to go on to adhere to surfaces. Like this is the underside of the microscope cover slip. So this is a droplet of Comirnaty that's been put on a microscope slide and then covered with a cover slip, and then we're looking through it at times 600, and it's probably more like times 1200 by the time you put it on the screen here. If I start the video here, you'll see I'm bringing it in and out of focus, and those colloidal structures are fusing or adpressing themselves onto the underside of the glass, and they're starting to form these very regular straight-edge right-angled structures. Some of them are very simple, like a little square or rhomboid structure, and some are more complex. So you'll see those, some larger ones in a minute. Okay, let's go to the next one. Okay, so this is the same scale. It's the same magnification. These are just larger structures of the same kinds of formation. So they go on increasing in size with time. I'll talk about how quickly these form and the conditions under which they form in a moment when I look at a lot more images. This is just a quick snapshot. You'll actually see some of these structures are formed on the top face of the microscope slide, and then some are formed on the underside of the cover slip. So you've got two, you've got like a sandwich where comernity is the meat in the sandwich, and then you've got the two slices of bread, which is the cover slip and the microscope slide. And so these two here are structures which are formed on, I think it's the underside of the cover slip. So if we start the video again, these ones here are actually on the top face of the microscope slide itself. And then as we bring it in and out of focus, we'll eventually go back to the underside of the cover slip here. There we are, we see. So you can see these are starting to get more complex. And this one has about a dozen sides to it. And they often have these very long features attached to a sort of a plate-like structure. But they're quite characteristic. You know, we've seen these in about three dozen preparations from two different vials of the same commodity. They've got serial numbers on them, but I don't know if they're the same batch, but they've come from two different vials. And then that culminates in this. This is a sort of image that's not that hard to find on social media or some internet sites. This is another worker. This is not my image. This is an image from another worker in New Zealand. And it seems to me that under certain conditions, the structures that I showed in the previous slide, they'll go on getting more and more complex. You can see the basic form. So if you were to take about 10 of these and combine them, this is the sort of thing you'll end up with. Right, so we've got very similar components here, straight edges. And this is about 5 times magnification higher than all my images. So this person was working with a higher magnification. I think it was probably the optics were around 1,000 to 1,500, and then it was taken up to about 4,000 with the software on that they were using to project the image. That's an example of the three different key findings. So now we're going to step back and go into those in more detail so that it makes more sense. So Pfizer's comirnaty, in brackets, COVID-19 mRNA injection, we're trying to address what does it contain. If we look at what's been disclosed, what it purports to contain is the mRNA, which is a specific in silico designed nucleotide sequence, which is supposed to encode for the spike protein. There are 4 different lipids in there. There are structural lipids and there are functional lipids. The structural lipid is a lipid that helps with the formation of the lipid nanoparticle structure. I'll explain what that is in a minute. And then the functional lipids are the lipids which help the messenger RNA get across the plasma membrane of the cells, ostensibly in the muscle at the site of the injection. So there's a bunch of different lipids in there. There are buffers, there are surfactants, stabilizers. And then, of course, there are the unknown but declared proprietary additives. There's at least 2. But there may well be other things in there as well. We just don't know. There does seem to be mounting evidence from other workers that there are features that people are coming across when they look at these COVID-19 gene therapy or vaccines, whatever you want to call them, under the microscope, either with the electron microscope or high-powered light microscope. There is accumulating evidence, and we'll talk more about what exactly that evidence is in a minute. But the thing to take note here, and the purpose of this slide, is just to remind the audience that there are some very good reasons for suspecting graphene oxide. It's not like people are pulling it out of a hat. Graphene oxide is a very exciting molecule in biotechnology at the moment. It's sort of like the golden child of many aspects of nanotechnology research and development, including medicine, including vaccine delivery. And so if you did a quick search in Google or one of these other search engines, it wouldn't take you long to find at least a couple of dozen papers that touch on the use of graphene oxide in medicine, and some of those will cover a specific use for vaccines. But there does seem to be a somewhat trite and glib coverage of the health and safety aspects. It seems that unlike other fields of drug research, vaccine research has a very low bar with just what constitutes adequate health and safety data before these things are entering the 1, 2, 3, 4 phases of trials. The bar seems to be a little bit low to me. some of the additives that we know are in vaccines, if you tried to put them in other drugs, then you'd come to a grinding halt very quickly with development. But it does seem that things have evolved such that it's much easier to put all kinds of excipients and additives into vaccines and get them approved without the same degree of scrutiny, particularly in terms of medium to long-term health and safety testing. And that is of great concern, particularly with something like graphene oxide, if it is present, because there are some very good reasons why many people believe that graphene oxide would never be safe as an in vivo treatment. And yet there's hundreds of millions of dollars of research going into this, just this one substance. So a bit more about comirnaty. So this is not hypothetical stuff. This is what is admitted by the mainstream. So comirnaty is manufactured to form self-assembling nanoshells. Now, what that means is that it's a colloid or emulsion of supramolecules called, probably most accurately called liposomes, which is a complex type of micelle. The best way to try and understand it is to think of something like cow's milk or any other of the many kinds of emulsions that we're familiar with. Cow's milk is primarily a suspension of fat droplets in water. So if you take, everybody knows what happens if you pour olive oil or any oil into water. It's very hard to get the two to become miscible. The oil will sort of glug down and then rise to the surface and just sit there. And you'll get two separate phases, an oil phase and a water phase. Well, when you're trying to formulate something that's basically not soluble in water, like many of the things that we might want to use as drugs or pesticides or biocides, you have to somehow solubilize that. So a standard way of doing that is to mix it with various solvents, co-solvents, surfactants. In fact, probably the best way to explain that is to move to this diagram here. So what you basically have is the nucleotide sequences, the mRNA, they're surrounded by lipids and surfactants. A surfactant is simply a molecule that has a polar end and a non-polar end. So it has a moiety, which is water-loving, hydrophilic, and then another sort of fatty end that is hydrophobic. What that does is it helps emulsify things. So it's a way of orientating something that would otherwise be insoluble in an aqueous phase to make it soluble. So there's about four different lipids. This, what's called a helper lipid here, this is probably cholesterol. We've got polyethylene glycol, which in this diagram is actually attached to another lipid. And so the coating, because remember, this is a sphere, it's not a flat plate. This is just a diagrammatic illustration. So it's like a cross section through a sphere.
I see, Robin, you've added a con at the start of the name there. I don't know if that was a typo or intentional, but it's quite funny.
Oh, that actually was a Freudian slip. It wasn't deliberate. Well, we'll leave it there, shall we? Anyway, so coming back to our previous diagram, each liposome contains about 50,000 molecules, mainly lipid molecules, but also the mRNA nucleotide sequences and all the other excipients. And then there's about several billion molecules. The reason that comirnaty is formulated in that way into these liposomes is partly to form a stable emulsion in the vial and in the syringe before it goes into the body, but it's also to enable it to get past the cell plasma membrane, which is normally a significant barrier. The cell plasma membrane is a very similar composition and structure as a liposome. It's like a key and a lock in a way, where they're very similar. What can also happen is that foreign messenger RNA nucleotides, in other words, artificial genetic code, may also become incorporated into the native DNA of the cell as a potentially permanent genetic alteration. And this is something that all the fact checkers have been very quick to deny and say is nonsense, but there's very good reason for suspecting that that could happen. In fact, it's a default position in many fields of genetic engineering. So just to assume that it wouldn't happen, having got past the plasma membrane, is somewhat bizarre. But there is actually some research, direct research now, suggesting that is precisely what happens.
Robin, we should just point out for the audience too that the molecule itself that they've designed is potentially toxic to both the cell and the nucleus because it contains synthetic nucleotides to stop it breaking down. And not only that, but it's encompassed in these lipid nanoparticles and potentially graphene structures, which also resist degradation. So we've got a type of molecule, the RNA, which is usually highly unstable, broken down inside the body quickly, which could persist for far longer than the body is used to dealing with and could set off its own problems in itself at a cellular level, even without production of the so-called spike protein.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It reminds me to tell the audience that the polyethylene glycol, polyethylene glycol is a well-established metabolic poison, has all kinds of interference mechanisms. It's quite a serious poison. For some bizarre reason, it seems to be okay to add it to a vaccine. But as I said, if you tried to add polyethylene glycol to most other drugs, you'd just get laughed out the door. It's really odd how easy it is to put these things in a vaccine and then claim that it's okay for some reason. It's really strange. So putting polyethylene glycol into the cytosol, on the face of it, is a completely insane thing to do. It's one of many, many, many questions that just don't seem to have been addressed. And whenever anyone tries to address it, it's like they're an instant heretic. It's really strange.
The same with the graphene oxide. There's quite a difference in the literature between the medico-pharmaceutical literature, which is all singing the praises of graphene oxide, versus the literature you see from the engineers who point out that it's an incredibly toxic substance.
Okay, we'll talk of the devil. Here it is again. So graphene oxide has properties that make it a natural candidate for artificial manipulation of important cellular, electrical, and genetic functionalities in humans, and of course their related pathologies and therapies. Of course, the emphasis in the literature is on therapies. However, the safety concerns are extensive, and there are logical reasons why these safety hurdles may be insurmountable. Given the nature of graphene oxide. For example, one of its remarkable properties is the ability to self-assemble into very shallow, one-atom thick sheets, which is a very remarkable quality. So that, plus the fact that it's not something that's naturally found in nature, so you can't get much narrower than one atom thick. Potentially that's narrow enough to get between the components of a nucleotide sequence. This is a diagram to illustrate scale. So I want it to be clear when I'm showing you the images, you know, what size we're talking about. So at the end here, we have a tennis ball. So a tennis ball is about 100 million nanometers across. Now at the other end, we've got a water molecule, which is about 0.1 of a nanometer. And then in the middle here, we've got bacteria. Here we've got a cancer cell, a red blood cell, which is got a diameter of about 7 to 8 microns. That would be somewhere in here too. Here we've got 1,000 nanometers, which is 1 micron. So bacteria tend to be a little bit smaller than a micron, or and then right up to about 5, 6, 7 microns, the really big ones. So anything from about here down in that direction, you're talking about an electron microscope. So anyway, the light microscope will see things in this range here. Most drugs are in the oil phase. Most drugs are not water soluble. So in order to get them into the aqueous phase, which is the living phase, if you like, then this is what you do. You emulsify them. As a rule of thumb, the smaller the droplets, the particles, the micelles, the liposomes, whatever you want to call them, the more stable they tend to be. It's much more complicated than that. And that's, size is only one thing that affects stability. But as a rule of thumb, that's still correct. Cow's milk is a suspension of fat droplets in water, and those droplets are 0.5 of a micrometer up to about 20 micrometers. Whereas comernity, the individual droplets or liposomes are smaller. They're between 100 and 150 nanometers. Okay, so what do we actually see in comernity? If we take a drop of comernity out of the vial and we put it on the microscope slide and we put a cover slip on it and then we look at that under a compound light microscope using phase contrast, what do we see? So let's have a look. As a point of reference, just so that you can be familiar with what other emulsions look like, we'll start with cow's milk. You'll see that there's this effect in the background. It's a bit like a snowstorm. Unfortunately, the software that extrapolates what's on the microscope and puts it on the screen, it gets a bit confused because there's hundreds of thousands of individual droplets there, and it simply can't sort those out. There's more droplets than there are pixels, for one thing. So it gets a bit confused. But you can kind of see the snowball effect there. Under the light microscope, you can actually see individual droplets, but they tend to get a bit splurged. The main point of showing you this is to show you what an emulsion looks like. And you can just see there's a sort of an effect of movement of lots of little particles there that are just outside the size range that's easily detectable with a light microscope. So there's a couple of larger things here, which are about 2, 3, 4 microns across, but most of these are sub-micron size, so they're starting to get quite difficult to see, but you can still just about perceive them, these little black dots. So phase contrast, it sort of makes things black or white, depending on the position of the focus. But I actually heated this myself to make sure it was pasteurized. So I wanted to be sure that none of that movement was to do with motile bacteria. So yes, I can confirm that there weren't any motile bacteria there, because the bacteria that may have been there would have been dead because I killed them. Now this, I wanted to make a point here. So what I did was I abused this milk emulsion by heating it just below boiling point, cyclically, by putting the microscope slide on a really hot radiator and then taking it off and putting it back on. So I didn't actually let it boil, but I did it until the emulsion broke. This is fat here. This is a fat, milk fat. And then all the casein and lipids that didn't crash have sort of coated the underside of the cover slip. So this is exactly what we would expect to see. So this is flu vaccine. I wanted to look at some other vaccine emulsions. It's actually a little bit clearer here that we're dealing with an emulsion. These droplets are slightly bigger than in homogenized milk, or they appear to be. So I'm bringing this in and out of focus, and you can kind of get the impression, you can just about see the individual droplets here. So these are sort of hovering either side of about a micron diameter. You get this sort of snowstorm effect. They're moving down just because I looked at this immediately after I prepared it, and the liquid hadn't settled yet, so it was still moving from top to bottom. So nothing very exciting now. As I say, it's just a point of reference. This is what happens when I broke the emulsion, so I deliberately destabilized the emulsion. This is one of the challenges with emulsion chemistry, is to produce something that's stable. So when you start heating things, changing the temperature cyclically, it's the sort of thing that will cause an emulsion to crash. So I just wanted to make the point that we're dealing with an emulsion. Hey presto, this is the confirmation. So on the left-hand side here, this is the oil phase, and this is the aqueous phase. And you can see some of the oil phase has come across into the aqueous phase there. As an aside, most of the emphasis or reference to graphene oxide is sort of 99% in relation to comernity, but there has been suggestions, or there have been reports, that graphene oxide may be in some of the flu vaccines also. And lo and behold, if I put the flu vaccine through a less severe heating regime, one that wasn't designed to mess up and break the emulsion, but just to introduce a little bit of heat, sort of thing that might happen when you inject a vaccine into a warm-blooded creature like a human. So I heated it up to about 40 degrees, so a little bit higher than body temperature. And we did seem to get these structures formed. Now, this is a structure that it has some similarities to what some types of graphene oxide are supposed to look like. If you imagine a piece of aluminium foil and you scrunch it up in your hand so that you get lots of layers all lying over the top of each other, lots of folds all folding over each other, that's what graphene oxide will sometimes do. So that may or may not be graphene oxide, and maybe a red herring, but nonetheless, I saw that quite a lot of images with that. So this was MMR. Someone also sent me some MMR vaccine as another point of reference. Again, starting the video, coming in and out of focus. You can see there's some sort of deposit forming on the glass, but there's most of it is just this emulsion. You can see the little snowstorm effect of the emulsion particles moving in the background here, all these little black dots moving around. So, you know, nothing particularly remarkable there. It's what you'd expect if you were looking at an emulsion. So it was a useful reference. This is water. When you take glass microscope slides and cover slips out of their package, if you don't go to a lot of effort, they tend to be charged with static electricity and they very quickly get lots of dust particles on them. I wanted to make the point that not everything you're seeing has got anything to do with comernity or the other things that we're looking at. Some of it's dust. So this is like a control. So this is just some water that came from a reverse osmosis filter. And that's exactly what you're seeing here. This is just water with some dust particles on the cover slip and the microscope slide. So if we just start it up, bring it in and out of focus, you can see some are on the underside of the glass, some are floating in the liquid, in the water between the cover slip and the microscope slide itself, and some are actually on the microscope slide. So that's just another point of reference, just to make sure that what we're looking at is real and not an artifact. Okay, so let's get into the comernity. This is comernity at time zero, or close to time zero. So we took a droplet out of the vial and plated it out, and so within less than a minute, we're looking at it in real time and recording what we're seeing, which is what you're seeing here. You see there's a very few larger droplets here. This is, you know, this is a vial that's probably been slightly abused. It hasn't come straight out of a cold fridge. It's, you know, it's been in transit. So there might have been a little bit of destabilization going on. But you can see that the vast bulk of it is still in a nice stable emulsion form. You can see the snowstorm effect of the emulsion in the background. There are lots of little droplets moving around, diffracting the light. So you're seeing like a light scattering effect. The light's bouncing off all those little individual liposomes or lipid nanoparticles. Okay, so this is 5 minutes later. The first series of slides I looked at, I didn't do anything other than just leave the microscope slides without any heat or any jiggery pokery. I just left them, and it's a bit tedious because it takes a while for anything interesting to happen. So I quickly learned that if you applied heat, it speeds things up quite markedly. This is a bit later on in the piece, so normally 5 minutes you wouldn't see any change at all, but 5 minutes plus a pretty vigorous heating regime. So I took this up to about 60 degrees centigrade, and this is the start of what starts to happen. So you see over here there's a little coalescence of the lipid nanoparticles into a much larger formation. So, you know, there might be about 100 liposomes. It's all coalesced there. That's most likely what's happened. I mean, that's a hypothesis, but it's hard to explain what else we're looking at here. Here we've got two little coalescences, so we'll call them large colloidal structures, two little beads starting to join together. So you can't really see much there, but once you get your eye in and you come back and look at one like this, you can see things. But what I'm going to show you in a minute will be much clearer with the later development. Let's jump right into one that was heat plus 45 minutes. So this is a little bit more exciting. We get these things. This is the one I showed you earlier, right at the beginning. So we've got these jellyfish-like structures. So like the head of the jellyfish here, and then these little beads forming a tail underneath. You can see them actually moving if we put the video on, bring it in and out of focus. And then there's this one here with the really long tail here. You can see it swishing around gently in there. You would expect to see some movement because there's all kinds of attraction and repulsive forces between the water-hating fat components of the colloidal moieties and then the water-loving part. So you've basically got oil in water. So there's all kinds of repulsive forces there which will naturally tend to make things move. So it's no great surprise that a long tail would be moving.
Just for our audience again, I mean, the particles we're looking at there, they are huge compared to what they said would form, because the lipid nanoparticles were supposed to be beneath or sub what a light microscope could see.
Yeah, then that's why we couldn't really see much. But so this is about 15 microns across this one. This little tail here will be, you know, way smaller than a micron. So the cross section of this narrow tail here is probably about 300 or 400 nanometers across. So getting close to the size of an individual lipid nanoparticle. That's a sort of a guesstimate. Might even be the same size.
Just for our audience to put it in perspective, a red blood cell is about 7 microns in size.
It's about half that size. Yeah, it's about half the size of that. So if you imagine, if you took that tail and chopped it into 100 pieces, you'd have something about the size of those little dots we saw whizzing around in the time zero. So this is just another illustration of the same sort of thing. You've got a coalesced colloidal structure here with two little smaller structures attaching. They tend to attract each other and join up. And there's one here, sort of an oval coalescence there. There's one here. There's actually hundreds of them. Once you get the eye in, you can see them. But some of them are right on the limit of detection. Well, that's about 10 microns across, 8.
If we think about bacteria like E. coli, say, which is only about 2 microns, we can get a comparison.
E. coli would be, we'd see it there, but it would be like some of these smaller particles. Slightly smaller than that one.
Yeah. So these complexes are already bigger than bacterial cells.
Yeah, the smaller ones. This is a very small, short video. Here you can see the same thing. There's a large colloidal sphere at the end, and then there's lots of a string of beads, a string of little droplets all joining up. So they're starting to coalesce, form more complex structures. This one's quite interesting. You only just see it. So if you look at right where my cursor finger point there is, start it up again, you can see a little head there with two tails on it. Looks a little bit like the squiddy thing from the Matrix movie.
Mm.
And then there's another one up here, a little string of beads.
Structurally wise, that's all lipid nanoparticle complexes. That doesn't seem to be like a graphene spindle.
My working hypothesis is that the graphene oxide, has surfactant properties of its own. So it's a natural candidate for mixing with the liposome. So it probably wouldn't be too difficult to actually simply slot the graphene oxide into the liposome as a surfactant. But now what you're looking at here, these tails are probably mainly lipids, and then there's probably lipids and nucleotides in the head. But you know, why we're getting these complex structures is we don't really know. I mean, I have seen similar things before in my days of formulating emulsions, but they're much rarer. Most emulsions are simply, you know, millions of little spheres, little nanospheres or microspheres. Sometimes they will form rods. So instead of arranging as a sphere, they will arrange as a long rod shape. These seem to be an order of complexity again. The form is hugely varied. So in the next one here, this is a really common, this happens within 5, 10, 15 minutes. So you get these different sizes. There's quite a large one there, a smaller one here. Most of them have tails, but not all of them. Some of them are like dumbbells. But once you get your eye and you can see that some of them are very small, they're just on the limit of detection. So some of them are quite small. Some of them are 10, even 100 times bigger. So there's almost a 10 to 100 size difference with some of these coalescences. And here's just one big oval sphere. So that'll be the reason that's probably slightly oval is it's probably so large it's been squashed between the carver slip and the microscope slide. So it's unable to form a perfect sphere. That's probably about 20 plus microns across.
So the possibility is that could have been even bigger, but it's just restricted by the in vitro study.
Possibly, although it seems that those other rod shape and sort of jellyfish shape structures are much more common than just the large spherical structures. So something like that, where you've got a combination of a tail and a head shape. This is just particularly grubby cover slip. It's got dust on it and grease. But the interesting thing are these things here. So we've got a little head here with a tail. There's another one here, but they're all over the place.
Robin, for our audience, is that an air bubble on the lower left?
Yeah, that's an air bubble, and this is just detritus. Because we're shining white light through here, sometimes some of these little particles will diffract the light rather like a prism and will separate it into its component colours. So there's something about the physicochemical properties of this bit of dust detritus here that's making it look yellow. Here's another one. And see that one moving from right to left. It's got a. They're not always perfectly spherical. Again, this one's probably a bit squished. But yeah, it almost looks like that one's moving under its own steam, but it's probably just floating with the bulk phase. But yeah, they're all over the place. Smaller ones here, here, and here. Okay, this is where it starts to get a bit more interesting. If you look at this one in the middle here, what we've got is a string of half a dozen little beads there. So there's a bead there, a bead there. And then sometimes, apparently spontaneously, some of these spherical beads start to form flat, rhomboid plate-like or cuboidal plate-like structures. And it's quite clear that they're coming from the beads themselves. They're not forming separately. But sometimes you can actually see the little droplets start to form these straight-edged, right-angled structures. And they're quite clearly attached to what are still round spherical structures, so that it seems almost certain that they are coming from the spherical structures. Okay, so here's one here. It looks a bit like a kite. You see that instead of having a spherical head, it's got a kite shape. It's got straight edges and right angles. And then it's got a tail of beads attached. So I'll start it up again and you'll see it moving. It looks like a kite that's been hooked up on a boulder right in the middle there. You see that?
Yeah, so Robin, what time frame are we looking at here?
But it would have been less than an hour from getting it out of the vial. Sometimes you get other weird and wonderful shapes. So this one has got a long series of droplets that have coalesced to form a rod. And then instead of having a droplet at the end, it's got like a loop. So this is like a rod or a thread, wire, which is looped back on itself, and it's just formed a loop. Now, what happens if you leave this standing for hours as opposed to minutes? I mean, you can accelerate things with magnetic fields and heat, but this sort of thing was happening after about 2 or 3 hours or even overnight. So what's happening is that these rod-shaped structures are starting to coalesce. Sorry, they're starting to add press and fuse to the surface of the glass. And sometimes they just sort of splurge onto the surface of the glass and nothing else happens. It just stays like that. But on other occasions, they start to form some very regular shapes. You can see there's a slight hint of it here and there, but if you hadn't seen the more ordered forms, you'd probably miss it. So you start to get slightly more complex plates. A lot of them are sort of four-sided. This one's sort of, there's a four-sided one. And then some of them start to get a bit more. That one's like an L shape. And you're also starting to get these wire-like straight edges. So for some reason, what was a sort of a wavy, quivery tail, once it starts to adhere to the surface of the glass, it starts to become extremely straight or sometimes curved. So something is changing. There's one that's sort of bent back around on itself. There's one that's got sort of like a spoke-like feel to it. So we'll play the video for that one and you can see it moving. So I'll bring it in and out of focus. And there are other ones here, 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 and here, all moving. These plate-like structures and the wires, they start to get longer and bigger, and they start to get slightly more complicated in shape. So this is something that's happening over time. These colloidal structures are starting to adhere to interfaces. Sometimes they will form in the free-floating liquid, particularly if they bump into another particle or an air bubble. They seem to need an interface to start this transformation. And here we are, starting to get a little more interesting. This is a very common shape. We get a sort of an oblong shape with straight edges, right angles, and then these little, it's almost like a cricket bat with half the handle snapped off. You see some of them are a combination of a wire and a, I'm just using the term wire because it's a very long coalescence of these individual colloidal beads that are just then, for some reason, becoming very straight. Okay, so this is an interesting aside. With this preparation of comunity, I actually put quite a powerful magnet on top of the cover slip and just left it overnight. My reasoning being that graphene oxide will respond to magnetic fields. when I looked at it the following morning, you get these very interesting patterns. And if you actually, what I think is actually happening here, what's the best way to explain it? If you imagine taking a sheet of glass and holding it over a bonfire, you get a thin layer of smoke on the glass. Anyone who's been in a building after a fire will see what smoke does when it hits glass. You get a very thin, you get a black layer of smoke. All the smoke particles deposit on the glass. So imagine that. So we'll imagine that some substance has coated the surface of the glass cover slip, and then the particulate, the larger particulate particles that happen to be nearby, in response to the magnetic field, are then moving, and they're leaving behind these trails. Now, that might sound far-fetched until you are familiar with this type of thing and you actually start looking at it in detail. It's harder to see on this one, but if you actually look at every protrusion, you will find there's always a little particle at the end. In every case, pretty much. I mean, some might have got sloughed off, but I think it's a bit clearer in the next one. See, there's a little particle there. It's a particle there. So it probably started here and moved down here. Came to there, there's one there, the particle there, there's a particle there, there's a particle there. See the end of all these little particles here, 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 here. There's one there. I think it's even clearer on the next one here.
And just to clarify, Robin, the magnet wasn't moving at all. It was staying in the same position.
Yeah, I just left it on top of the cover slip overnight.
So it's in the same position, but these particles are going all over the place.
Yeah, well, I think so. I've seen similar things before with things that aren't like confirmed we're actually moving. This is I can't think of any other explanation for this kind of pattern. You can see there's a little particle there. It's like it's looped around there. Let's come along here. There's one there. There's one there. There's one at the end of there. There's one at the end of there. Almost in every case, you find a little particle at the end. And again there. Now, why it suddenly stopped and didn't just carry on until the whole thing was whited out, as it were, I don't know. Maybe it was combined with a drying effect and there was a loss of fluidity and the rheology changed. So there was a timing factor. So, you know, this can only move if there's enough. There's not too much friction. So there's probably a fluid component to, or a drying effect going on as well. But I'm pretty sure there was some movement going on there of something. This sometimes, for whatever reason, we get fewer plates and we get mainly straight rods. You can see there's a plate that started to form and then it just kind of morphed into this long wire-like structure. But these are quite clearly forming from the colloidal structures. So why they form these very straight edges, straight lines, is a bit of a mystery. Now, some crystalline material will do this, but there's some things here which are very different to how crystals behave. I'll come back to that in a minute.
And this one's not, that's not under a magnet, this one?
No, that wasn't. No, the only one was at a magnet was that one with that hypothetical movement hypothesis. So this is coming, coming back to the plates. You can start to see they have sometimes have these, some people have referred to these as antennae. The structures are starting to get more complex. That one looks a bit like a pipe, smoking pipe. But there's a certain commonality to what's going on here. There's lots of straight edges, right angles, all sort of stacked on top of each other. It's like kids' bricks in two dimensions, just being stacked in different ways. Now it's starting to get a little bit more complex. You can see one here is quite a long wire coming off that one. Sometimes they stop forming. I think maybe they run out of the right rheology for their growth process and things stop, or maybe the trigger stopped. Who knows? Same sort of thing there. So these spherical colloidal bodies, they always, or nearly always, start to form these much straighter edge right angled structures, which is pretty unusual. I mean, crystals don't usually form from a colloid like that, in my experience. There's something strange about this colloid. Okay, so here's this. Maybe this is the same magnification. I haven't blown this up at all. I haven't increased the magnification. So these are just larger structures of the same kind of thing. So you've got straight edges, and that's about as far as they went with me. Some of them were a little bit more complicated than that, but other workers have found that they go on growing and forming more complex structures. Other people have been a bit more adventurous with what they do to their slides, like they've been taking them to 5G towers and various other jiggery-pokery. I only attempted to do that once, and it certainly seemed to bring changes on more rapidly, but I didn't do it often enough to know whether it was a real effect or not. What this shows when I played a video where I move the focus to a greater depth or a more shallow depth, you'll see that these structures, some of them are formed on the underside of the cover slip. I think these two were, and then there are more. You can just see their outline here. Those are formed on the top side of the microscope slide, but you'll see them both clearly. So it starts at the top face of the microscope slide, and I'm coming out of focus, and then you'll start to see the other ones. Oh, I've gone back too quickly, but just be patient. Here we are. There's the two underneath the cover slip. So they form interfaces. So they're almost two-dimensional. I mean, they do have a depth, but if they are graphene oxide, then they're going to be very thin. Maybe one atom thick, perhaps, which is why they're forming like that.
Like inside a human body, we'd expect that interface to perhaps happen like on a blood vessel on the wall.
Well, the human body is just a billion miles of interfaces. So every cell has a plasma membrane around it, which is effectively an interface with the plasma, the blood. So you've got interfaces everywhere in the body. So there's plenty of scope for... This is why graphene oxide would be a particular concern. There are so many places where it could form these sheets, as it's known to do in vitro. These are not my images. These are images that are available on the internet. And so it looks to me very much like these structures are simply extensions of what I'm seeing. You know, we've got the same straight edges, and their magnification is or at least about five times higher than mine, so the scale would fit too. So if you multiplied the size of those larger ones of mine by 3, 4, 5, you've pretty much got bang on the same sort of size, and then you've got the same straight edges. You often get these long protrusions. These are just a bit more complicated. They seem to be forming much more complex structures. I suspect as we do more work with this, we'll come up with protocols for making this happen very consistently. Here's another one, not dissimilar. It's another one. So that some people have said, oh, these are just crystals. You know, you're just looking at crystals, and just people just leave it at that, come up with these very trite commentaries, which, okay, so, well, that's a fair enough comment, but when people make comments like that, we just need to press people to go deeper. Okay, so it's a crystal. So what in the comernity mixture would you expect to form crystals? If for the disclosed ingredients, we can rule those out straight away because we know how they behave. They don't form crystals under the conditions that we're looking at. So, okay, so maybe it's one of the undisclosed. And do they actually look like crystals? Well, the answer is they don't really look like crystals. Anyone that's familiar with crystallography will think, oh, we've discovered a new crystal at best, and they'll try and think, well, what is it that could be forming such a weird crystal like that? Because it's certainly like no crystal I've ever seen. The other way of addressing it would be to say, okay, well, what's in comernity and what could be forming a crystal? So unfortunately, this kind of feedback, it's just a cherry-picked knee-jerk, oh, you're just looking at something that's not important, right? They never really address the issue, but it just occurred to me that we could actually look at some sodium chloride crystals. So I just prepared a supersaturated solution of pink Himalayan salt, and then just allowed it to start forming crystals under the cover slip. Of course, when a crystal forms, it doesn't just form in two planes. So that's an obvious difference between these crystals, or these sodium chloride crystals that we know and understand and love, and these other strange structures that are only really forming in a very, they're almost two-dimensional. They're not going up towards you. As we can see with this sodium chloride, as it formed, it was lifting the cover slip up because it's expanding in three dimensions. It's not just going on a very shallow plate in two dimensions, top to bottom, left to right. It's coming out towards us. But anyway, we can see these classic cuboidal crystals here. You know, they look like crystals. We know what crystals look like. And if we play the video here, bringing it in and out of focus, you can get a feel for the individual crystals. And then some of them are like mountain ranges. So some of these are so thick that they've lifted up the cover slip. And so that's what a typical crystal looks like. Most crystals they have this property of birefringence. So you can look at them under the plain polarized light. This is what a lot of geologists do. Geologists use a similar polarized light setup to the one I use for looking at wood and other things, because wood is crystalline like a lot of minerals are. So it's very useful to be able to detect the amount of crystallinity that's retained by a crystalline material, because it's a way of measuring degradation of a crystal. But anyway, I've actually used this. This is the one image where I didn't use phase contrast. I went back to bright field and polarized light. And so I've got like semi polarized light here. So I've taken out some of the light using a polarizer, and it helps show the crystallinity and the refractiveness of the crystals. So crystals have this property of that's called birefringence, and they convert plain polarized light back into bipolar light. That's not to say that they're absolutely not crystals, but there's certainly a lot of reasons to think they're not crystals. Yeah, so this is just another image of sodium chloride. You can actually see this edge. These crystals form very quickly, so I could actually watch these forming in real time. I think I actually played this, like the video only went on for about half a minute, but I watched it for about 5 minutes because it was so fascinating. You could see it advancing across the face. So it was these crystals are forming quite quickly. I've never seen that with the, almost never with the whatever's forming from those colloidal structures. They, as I said, sometimes the individual beads or droplets in a string of beads would transform into a plate or a rhomboid, straight-edged, right-angled structure. But that was, you know, you had to look a long time to see something like that. Whereas these crystals are expanding quite quickly and you can see it every time. So to sum up some of the key observations and thoughts that arise from those, it appears to me as if the colloidal material is self-assembling into a highly ordered, right-angled, perfectly straight-edged structure, which goes on increasing in complexity in response to some kind of environmental trigger, which we don't fully understand yet. It's quite difficult to explain this. Hypothetically, what would be the minimum requirements for such formations so we can start to produce a working hypothesis as to what might be happening? As I said, graphene oxide presents itself as a logical candidate constituent given its known features and properties. Like, it does have this property of forming very shallow sheets. It has surfactant properties. We know that there's been a lot of interest in certain medical fields, including vaccine delivery mechanisms, other drug delivery mechanisms, gene therapy, also in cancer research. So there's been quite a lot of work already that's touched on graphene oxide because it has these remarkable properties that lend themselves to some of the functionalities that some of these therapies or alleged therapies are attempting to achieve, basically drug delivery in our case. So perhaps an environmental trigger is causing the graphene oxide that's contained in the colloid to form a more ordered structure. I seem to be able to start to do it with heat, and the one time I actually went and drove around where some of the 5G towers are supposed to be located in New Zealand. But of course, you don't know whether they're turned on or whether they're turned on to the right frequency. So, but anyway, something like graphene oxide, which is a conductor, it does respond to electricity. It does respond to magnetic fields. You would expect it to change its form in response to those triggers. So, you know, it's fairly logical derivation. Graphene oxide is a conductor. It does respond to electrical and magnetic fields, probably including those that are known to occur in the human body. You know, like heart muscle is a very electrical material. There's all kinds of electrical activity in throughout the body. And the body is very sensitive to changes of these electrical fields. It wouldn't be a great surprise to find that a colloidal form of graphene oxide would start to behave in a way that is a response to the environment. So it wouldn't surprise me at all that the right EMF frequency might cause some of these effects. So lots more scope for more work from more people.
No, that is absolutely fantastic, Robin. I think what was really important was to see the whole thing from the start, taking the product, putting it under the slide and watching what happens over time, watching what happens, exposing it to temperature and various electromagnetic forces. So that was fantastic. And I think it does tie in with what the overseas teams have found with regards to probable graphene oxide in the injections. Some of the teams overseas have obviously backed this up with mass spectrometry. What I'll do for the audience is also link to some of the findings from the overseas teams like the Quintec Alumna and our own team here in New Zealand, Life in the Blood, and some of the reports that they've been producing that you can check out as well. And I think Robin's findings have been very consistent with the presence of graphene oxide and some very interesting findings with how that's behaving. Now, we really appreciate your contributions, and this is another important chapter to the story. So thank you very much. And if you have thank any you. New findings, we'll be sure to get you back on to report back to everyone.
Yeah, I will be investigating the EMF a bit more. I do have a little bit more material now to do that with, so I'll keep you posted.
That'd be great. Cool. Thank you, Robin.
Okay. Goodbye.
To help sustain my channel in this time of censorship, please support my work on Subscribestar. Link is in the description. So that we don't lose touch, please find me at drsambailey.com and sign up for my free newsletter.